the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, today my question is this. We've seen a system work for years, especially since Bretton Woods, and our monetary system has been set up with the United States being the primary reserve currency of the world. When that system stops working, people still continue to think that way errantly. And my question would be this. Has it changed? And should we change our thinking as far as the dollar being the reserve currency and the United States being the number one leader in world economy?
Kevin, we're in the middle of a transition, and it's a transition from an old monetary regime to a new one, and it really has yet to be determined what that new regime looks like. Is it some combination of the dollar playing a smaller role in combination with the euro, the British pound, the Japanese yen? Is it some sort of a regime that is headed and directed by the International Monetary Fund and the Bank of International Settlements from Switzerland? We will see exactly how it gets put together over the next probably 12 to 24 months. But what is, what was, and what may be, these are some things that I think are coming more and more into focus as we look at the issues which are the real cause behind this transition. Why have a transition at all?
David, could we possibly just, for review's sake, let's review what is. What is the paradigm right now? What was? Where were we coming from? And then what will we be going towards? Let's start out with the what is.
Well, if you look at the post-World War II era, Kevin, you've got a very unique thing occurring. We are an empire, but we're not an empire. And it's this quasi-identity where we certainly want influence in the world, but we don't want control. So we have U.S. troops stationed globally, and we ensure against future conflicts, you know, if you recall the red threat of a bygone era. So while we maintain political stability and work towards more or less a quote-unquote perfect world, this is our presence overseas. This is why we're there. We're there to help.
So in other words, it pays to be a cooperative partner or a friend of America because we're going to give them protection and possibly money or what have you.
We're the world's policeman. Yeah. We're the world's largest consumer. Not only can we protect you, but we can make you rich. Mm-hmm. And that's why you want to be tied into a U.S.-centric system, because we'll keep you safe and we'll also make you rich.
But as a cooperative partner, what do we need to give in return? Let's say we're a foreign country. To be a cooperative partner and be protected under this system, what's the return expectation?
Well, a part of the quid pro quo was the recycling of dollars. And we've seen that over the last several decades. If you look at the foreign account surpluses with our trade, various trade partners, we have a deficit, they have surpluses. What happens, Kevin, is when we buy widgets and gadgets and gizmos, that money goes straight over to our trade partner, and they can either direct it as an investment into their economy, into their currency, which would increase the value of their currency, or they can put it right back into treasuries or some sort of U.S.-denominated paper, which artificially boosts the value of the U.S. dollar and artificially depresses the value of their own currency, making them more competitive as a trade partner. That has been sort of the dollar recycling, along with sort of a stated military presence, either in their country or in the region. You have to live with that.
And I remember the interview with Paul Craig Roberts. He was talking about how our trade deficit to these, you know, partners or these cooperative friends of America, our trade deficit to them was about the same as what was coming back in and paying for our budget deficit. So they would come in, recycle, buy treasuries, and then we would go further into debt. But this cycle continued until now, where the budget deficit is just, it's astronomical. What is it? $1.8 trillion.
Now, the problem is government doesn't stop spending in an environment like this. In fact, we've got the latest numbers, and it was going to be $1.35 trillion as a budget deficit. It's going to be $1.6 trillion instead. So, Kevin, it's not like we're tightening our belts. In fact, if you look over the last 5 years, you've seen Congress take a number of pay raises. The first one was over a three-year period, a 15% increase, and then this last year, another 10% increase in pay. If you think about that, our leadership should be doing everything they possibly can to demonstrate that they are a part of and experiencing the same recession that the man on the street is. Instead, what they're going to do is rain down hellfire and brimstone upon themselves in the form of a November election when people say, you've done this to us, you weren't there with us, and you're certainly not representing a vote for us.
Mm-hmm.
And so, Kevin, I think one of the things that we're seeing change on a much broader picture, stepping away from the November election, is that as a country, we are losing influence. We're losing power and a real role in the world. We were north of 30%, Kevin, in terms of global GDP, and this is just 10 years ago. And today, we're right around 24%. We've seen about a 25% drop in terms of our GDP contribution over the last 10 years. And I think what you're seeing is a fading of a role of leadership on the world scene.
Is this a little bit like what the British Empire went through 80, 90 years ago, where they were the number one power, and then where are they now? I mean, it's just almost gone.
And they certainly are a first-rate first world country. The difference is a very marginal one,
mm-hmm.
where we take a half a step back and the rest of the world takes a half a step forward. And that half a step forward for the rest of the world on a relative basis is a major major step ahead in terms of progress. And for us, it just again means that we're less important in terms of what we're directing and trying to influence through our foreign policy and the things that we benefit from having troops stationed globally. So that's what was, what may be. We think it's highly probable that, if you want to call it singular nature of the world monetary regime focused on the U.S. dollar, think that's come to an end, and we'll explore that a little bit today.
Well, it seems this last decade has been a period of time that, you know, a lot of people are calling it the lost decade for America. I mean, what is it saying about the United States dollar and our power base worldwide?
I think you look at this decade as a decade of lost confidence, Kevin. Right. Sentiment has changed dramatically, and if you want to look at one expression of concern, as we mentioned in last week's show where we talked a little bit about the gold market, there is an expression of concern with the status quo. And if you look at a 10-year chart of the gold market, what you see is global disaffection or disinterest with a U.S.-centric monetary system. It's not just that gold is going up mm-hmm. and that the dollar is going down, but you can read between the lines and see a socio-political move away from a dollar and U.S.-centric world. And I think that's largely what you're seeing in the price of gold moving up. Because, to be honest with you, the supply and demand dimensions in the gold market, the demand side of that equation is being driven by global markets. And again, you have to ask why. You have to ask why. If in the environment of the U.S. dollar declining and those foreign currencies, relatively speaking, appreciating, why would there be more and more global interest in gold? And I think you have to say a large part of it is not knowing exactly how things will pan out in terms of a new monetary regime, and it's a hedging of bets.
Well, like on last week's program, you had read a Princeton quote that talked about how the price of gold is really a measure of a loss of confidence in the government. We're seeing that in the price of gold against not only the dollar, but if you look at the price of gold, even against the other currencies worldwide, there's a loss of confidence there, too.
Now, there's three things I want to make sure we cover today, Kevin. One is discussing kind of, as we mentioned earlier, a currency regime change, if you will. Two, we'll talk a little bit about the bond market, because I think we've come to an inflection point there. And last but not least, the banking market, and what we look at is sort of the second round of deleveraging, which on the face of it would be incredibly deflationary, and we'll explore that idea somewhat in terms of the practical implications and considerations. Last but not least, we'll also talk about, as we just mentioned, kind of the rise of the rest, if you will, where the U.S. is taking a half a step back, the rest of the world is taking a half a step forward, and on a relative basis, that is a significant improvement in terms of the stature, in terms of the wealth creation, in terms of the role and functions, you know, whether it's the G8, the G20, you're going to see a much more significant role with the up-and-coming and emerging markets compared to the role that the world has seen the U.S. play over the last few decades.
Well, David, you often talk about paradigms and paradigm shifts. Yeah, I think it might be worth actually going back and talking about what is a paradigm shift and what are we shifting from. Let's start with the currency.
Yeah, that reference is to Thomas Kuhn's book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, and what it implies is a complete reassessment of a given system. When Kuhn looked at it from the standpoint of science and the practicing ideas within a scientific paradigm, basically you've got people just going to work and doing their thing, you know, wearing their white smocks and measuring things in a beaker, running on a certain set of assumptions.
It's always worked before.
This is what science is about. This is why we do what we do, and this is what we're trying to prove.
Right.
What happens within a scientific community or any community is that if you have one anomaly or one problem, it's no big deal. If you have 10, you start to wonder if the assumptions that you're operating on the basis of are legitimate. If you have 100 different anomalies or problems that your theory, quote-unquote, does not account for, then you get to the point where, again, the whole system has to be reassessed, and you start with a whole different set of assumptions.
David, it reminds me of before Copernicus, when people actually thought, or a large majority of the people thought, that the whole universe circled the globe. Well, they could figure it out. It was a very complicated formula to figure out why Mars would go backwards into retrograde and all these things, but all you had to do was look at the sun being the center. But they say that generation really never got their heads around that. Now, even after Copernicus talked about it, and even after proofs came out, the idea of changing your thinking when something's worked so well, or you've thought so much of a past paradigm.
That was a revolution in itself.
It's a leap.
To a heliocentric system.
Yeah, it's a leap.
You know, you've got Foreign Affairs, the folks at the CFR, who in the fall of this last year said, we will soon share the stage with others as the world reserve currency. Singularity is a thing of the past. Now, I don't have to tell you how important it is for one of the most influential groups of thinkers in the world to be sort of forecasting and positioning in advance of what will occur over the next few years, and that is a passing of the baton. Again, singularity is a thing of the past. What I'd like to do, Kevin, is just look back a little bit before we look ahead and anticipate what might be some sort of a structure through the IMF or the Bank of International Settlements, some sort of new monetary regime. What we had in the period of 1870 to 1914 was the gold standard. And it was interrupted in 1914 by World War I. Actually, if you look at the British system, it started in 1717. And so you've got a little bit more history of, you know, a world leader having something other than a fiat or paper promise as their currency system.
And you could walk into a bank with a $20 bill and walk out with a full ounce of gold, because that was the commitment.
That was the commitment under the gold standard. And you had that under the Latin Monetary Union. You had under the Scandinavian Monetary Union. You had all of these different regional blocks who agreed to have a certain amount of gold equal a certain amount of francs, as it were, or kroner, as it were, or U.S. dollars here in the U.S. And what changed, Kevin, was in 1922, and this was in place from 22 to 1944, a substitute for the gold standard, which was called, very subtly, the gold exchange standard. And the gold exchange standard, what it did is it included the U.S. dollar and the British pound as reserve assets. So a central bank could essentially, under the gold standard, have gold as a reserve asset. So under the gold exchange standard, 1922 to 1944, you can have not only gold as a reserve asset, you can also have the paper version in dollars or British pounds also as a reserve asset.
So it diluted that exchange standard to actually start including paper as gold.
It meant there was less demand for gold in the open market. It also meant that you could settle accounts in paper script. It also meant that reserve assets could now collect interest and not just dust. And that was a significant transition, one that was favored by bankers for obvious reasons. Now, 1944, we entered what was the Bretton Woods Agreement. I think all of our listeners know what that was, but basically the U.S. dollar was backed and exchangeable into gold in the foreign markets. And we, the U.S. dollar, became the world's reserve currency. So any foreign exchange was done in dollars, and ultimately we could settle those dollar obligations in gold.
Which is a huge privilege, if you think about it. The United States has lived a privileged or a blessed life because of this reserve currency status.
Now, I might mention, Kevin, that 1944 overlaps pretty well with 1939 to 1945, which was the period where we began to see our government grow in size. And in fact, we've seen our government grow from 4 to 5 million total employees to close to 30 million employees. And for the first time in U.S. history, just here in the last few years, there are more people working for the U.S. government than there are in manufacturing
in the
United States.
Wait a second. So there are more people working for the government than people actually making things in the United States?
That's right. There used to be 2.5 to 3 times the number of people out there making things productively than there was people managing, quote-unquote, our system of government. Now, there are close to 5 million more government employees
than manufacturing.
Than manufacturing jobs.
Boy, that doesn't sound like that can last.
Well, let's face it. There's a lot of things that you can do when you're not tethered to something as solid as gold. You can continue to paper over those kinds of problems when there is ultimately no tether at all. And that's what we entered into, Kevin, the most recent period, if you want to call it the Bretton Woods II era or the post-Bretton Woods period. That's 1971 to the present. And the reason why we're belaboring this, Kevin, is because this is the first time in U.S. and world history, first time globally, universally, that we've had a fiat money system. That is, where you look at a paper dollar and it says, it's backed by the full faith and credit of whatever central bank is represented on that note. Full faith and credit, as opposed to, this is a trust instrument, as opposed to, you know what's backing this? Gold, period. We can't play with the money because we can't play with gold. And that's what was, and now we know what is, in terms of a universal fiat system. The only exception to that, Kevin, in the 71 to present period, up until about 1999, 2000, was the Swiss. It did have some backing to their currency system up to that point.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. You know, this is amazing, David, that Jacques Roof wrote a book called The Monetary Sin of the West 10 years before that 1971 period that basically laid out what would happen if we were allowed to paper over this system. I mean, remember talking about the monetary sin of the West.
Yeah, and I think one of the things I'd encourage our listeners to do, you can actually download a copy of that from our website. It's now in sort of the free domain. If you want to own a hardback copy, you probably pay $60 to $100 for it, but I'm pretty sure it is on our website as a downloadable PDF file. That is a book that every central banker should read. I would say it's required reading for our clients. Trust me, it'll take you twice to read through it for some of the content to really sink in.
Well, just give a little background on Jacques Roof. Who was Jacques Roof?
Between 1930 and 1934, Roof was the financial attaché at the French embassy in London. And if you think about those dates, 30 to 34 was when the world financial system was falling apart. He learned in the midst of travail and trial about a bank collapse, about currency devaluation, about what was the global financial crisis of his day. He's this old codger, move forward from 30 to 34 up until the 1960s. He's got a little age under his belt. He's got a little experience under his belt.
And now he's working for Charles de Gaulle.
That's right. He's the Minister of Finance to Charles de Gaulle. And it was his ideas in the mid-60s which caused de Gaulle to start taking gold instead of paper scrip for the dollar obligations that were coming to the French at the time. What was interesting, Kevin, is this. There was, according to Bretton Woods, this settlement process and this guarantee, according to Bretton Woods, which allowed you to take gold instead of paper assets. That was, you know, hey, listen, if the dollar is as good as gold, then take gold if you prefer. We'll just keep it convenient and you can take dollars instead. What that assumed is that we actually had a healthy balance.
He called their bluff.
Yeah. He absolutely called their bluff. And actually, the rules changed in 1968. The window was officially closed in 71, but the rules changed in 68 when the U.S. monetary authorities started requiring a preview of all requests. Instead of just an automatic settlement in gold, they got to look at who was requesting. There was this time delay before the request was fulfilled. And of course, there was this concept of, are you a friend of America? Mm. America's friends settle in cash rather than gold bullion because you trust us and we trust you and we don't have any political problems. We don't have any geopolitical problems. This is again where we had already spent our way into an imbalanced position. And this is why Roof was so critical at the time of our balance sheet and why he wanted gold instead. But we were in a position where because of power, because of, again, the status quo in the post-World War II era, which was we have troops regionally which protect you and you will recycle your money into U.S. dollar obligations. That dollar recycling process had already begun. We didn't want anyone calling our bluff. Yeah. We didn't want anyone noticing our balance sheet instability, or if you want to go so far as to say insolvency.
So it really takes us back all the way to the Genoa Conference in 1922, where this began, where no longer did they have to maintain enough gold to pay back on the dollars. That's when they started diluting that.
That's exactly right. That's when they started playing games. And as you mentioned, it was the International Monetary Conference. You had a gathering of 34 countries, and they were discussing monetary and financial matters in the post-World War I era. You know, how are we going to pay back debts? What does this look like? We need a little bit more flexibility. And again, it was very pragmatic, and it seemed to make sense at the time. On that basis, let's allow for paper as a reserve asset in addition to gold as a reserve asset. So they've changed rules sort of in the middle of the
Based on an emergency, a little like what we're seeing right now. It's like, well, hey, we're in an emergency. We don't have to follow practical guidelines.
This is one of the remarkable things about the gold standard, Kevin, is the most important feature was that there was a natural and automatic way for foreign account deficits and surplus to be balanced. Mm-hmm. And so whenever you had inflation and deflation emerging, there was this balancing, this automatic gold exchange mechanism, which moderated those trends. And so booms and busts were much more modest in comparison. That's why during the gold standard era, you had 1 to 2 year periods of boom and a half to 1 year of a bust, or a 3 year period of boom and a 1.5 year period of bust.
Yeah, but never 16, 17 years at a time.
And it was not cataclysmic.
Yeah.
It was not cataclysmic. So, Kevin, you had the League of Nations meeting in Genoa that allowed for that change. So, Kevin, here are the significant dates. If you're looking at the 1870 to 1914 period, the Genoa Conference in 1922 remade things, so to say, mm-hmm. and then it wasn't adjusted until 1944 with the Bretton Woods Agreement. If you look at the way Jacques Rouffe describes what was set in place, he described this as the deficit without tears. Mm-hmm. This is when the currency of one of the chosen countries, specifically the British or the U.S., you could run deficits, and it really didn't matter, because rather than creating a mild deflation in your country and a mild inflation in the surplus country, your trade partner country, which of course would have been balanced out under the gold standard, the more convenient thing or politically expedient thing to do in this environment, Kevin, was for them to roll that surplus currency back into dollars and buy investments in the deficit country, which in this case is the U.S. So you have the buying of treasuries, you have the buying of agency paper, you know, this whole thing that has been going on for the last decade and longer, Kevin. This is very familiar to us, but it's what Rouffe named the deficit without tears. And so he saw this coming long ago. We create inflation in other countries rather than seeing a dramatic increase in asset prices and currency valuations there. Our creditors recycle that liquidity back into the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially for us, Kevin, it's credit expansion on steroids.
Yeah, free money, basically.
Yeah, and so this system does raise the exposure of our trade partners to dollar assets, and it also at the same time promotes a misallocation of capital, while at the same time artificially suppressing bond yields.
Yeah.
All of these things are present tense realities, and it's one of the reasons why the anomalies, that they represent problems that have to be solved, and the current system, as we said, the current paradigm won't solve them.
Is it any wonder that the rest of the world wants to look at other options at this point?
Yeah, because we look at U.S. treasuries, and risk is inadequately accounted for. You look at U.S. mortgages, and you can still borrow money at 5.25%, you know, up from 4.75% just a few months ago. Now it's 5.25% for 30 years.
Yeah, but wait just a second, David. Tim Geithner this week said that we're not going to see our treasury paper downgraded. So are we not at AAA? Are we not at 100%? Can we not run these deficits without tears for time immemorial?
Kevin, I think this is where our mandarins on Wall Street and in Washington are simply lost. They're not keeping up. They're living this illusion that somehow things are not changing around them. It's almost as if, as academics, they've still got their heads stuck in the books and they don't realize what's happening on the streets. Because, Kevin, that is exactly what is happening. The world wants to look at other options. The world is no longer interested in propping up Americans' lifestyles, and they are not going to tolerate subsidizing our consumptive habits.
Isn't the bond market a good meter for what the world is actually saying right now?
It is, and I think it's preposterous for Geithner to, particularly as an academic, be able to step in and say, we cannot lose. We cannot lose our AAA rated status. I mean, what that says to me, Kevin, is that Geithner saying we cannot lose our AAA status, he's either now at the point of desperate cover-up, or that is anything but a veiled threat.
Well, what does Bill Gross say? I mean, people have been listening to Bill Gross on bonds now for years.
And the new CEO at PIMCO, Mohamed Elarian, one of the brightest guys, he actually ran the IMF for a good many years, now runs PIMCO as their CEO. He says, I would much rather own German bonds than U.S. Treasuries. Hmm. This is not an environment that I want to own U.S. Treasuries. I would prefer German bonds to U.S. Treasuries.
Well, and didn't Bill Gross, also of PIMCO, say that's not a question of if, but when the United States loses its rating?
Well, exactly. So, I mean, you've got the politicians or the policy wonks, if you will, with their heads stuck in the books, assuming that their theories, the ones that they defended in their master's theses, the ones that they defended in their PhD theses, are somehow still valid and relevant. They're trying to prove a point. This is now a question of academic pride. It's not a question of, are you aware of what's happening? Do you realize that there are people exiting the U.S. dollar, that last year there was a net liquidation of treasuries, and this in an environment where we need a growing number of people to subsidize not a $1.35 trillion dollar budget deficit, but a $1.6 trillion budget deficit.
Well, maybe they should take their hint from the municipalities, these municipal bonds that are being downgraded as we speak.
Well, exactly. We've got Illinois, California, Arizona already downgraded. And what you see is an increased cost of capital in those states if you're going to borrow the municipalities. And a part of the reason they're being downgraded is because their income is off. How does a state generate an income? It's not a business, is it?
And they can't print money.
That's right. They can't print money. They're solely dependent on tax revenues.
Yeah.
And we saw our tax revenues at the federal level, when you wrap it all together, income tax revenues for the U.S. down about 7% last year, down about 7%.
So when somebody's actually becoming a creditor, either for the United States government or a municipality, I mean, what do they really care about? What are they looking for?
Solvency, cash flow, income. Cash flow and income in the short term, and ultimately they want to know if you're going to default. Can you make your payments, and ultimately are we going to lose out here through default? And, you know, I think what we need to be aware of is that the total indebtedness of about $21 trillion by the end of 2020, that's a 10-year projection, official government projection will be at $21 trillion. This would be a miracle, Kevin. But if rates, interest rates were to be what they are today.
These low rates that we have, yeah.
Artificially low rates, you're talking about a $600 billion a year minimum interest payment on our national debt.
Just the interest alone, $600 billion. That's if interest rates stay low and our debt is no higher than what the government says it will be.
And I think you can assume slightly higher interest rates, and I think you can assume probably $4 to $5 trillion extra, say $26 to $27 trillion by the time we get, you know, 10 years out. So, Kevin, basically, if you're a foreign creditor and you're looking at the U.S. balance sheet, you're realizing that these debts simply are not payable. They're not payable. We've got not only the new debts, as we've mentioned in past programs, the $2.5 trillion in rollovers of existing debt obligations that have to come due over the next 2 years. So I don't see any way out for this. Corporate taxes off 56% this last year. State sales taxes down 10 to 16%. And as I mentioned, federal taxes off about 7%, all for 2009. So all this assumes that we can go to our current creditors and they'll continue to buy agency paper and treasury paper like they have been over the last 20 to 30 years. And nothing could be further from reality, Kevin. Nothing could be further from reality. Rates will rise. National debts will continue to rise. Downgrades of sovereign paper will make it virtually impossible to maintain the status quo. And this is the real point. We're not talking about the Greeks here, Kevin.
Right.
93% of debt to GDP. We're at 141%. The markets are ticked because the Greeks are the problem. Spain's the problem at over 100%. What about us? Geithner has the gall to say we can't be downgraded. And yet the downgrades are already flying in the south of Europe. What makes him so extra special? What makes us so extra special?
Well, let me ask you a question, though, David. Don't you think the government bureaucracy is going to preserve themselves first, no matter what they have to say?
They'll do everything they can. That's certainly the route that the Japanese took. That's what's kept them in a recession for 19 years. Kevin, I think that the monetization scheme they have in place, although they're talking about pulling it in March, it's virtually impossible to pull that away. You know, we've got real estate market, which is very frail and represents that sort of litmus test for how Americans feel about their personal wealth. That market was propped up in 2009 by $1.25 trillion, $100 billion a month of Federal Reserve balance sheet being committed to monetizing mortgage-backed securities and agency paper. Mm-hmm. Kevin, if we pull away the punch bowl at this point, you're talking about a collapse in real estate. You're talking about a collapse in sentiment. You're talking about a collapse in consumer sentiment. And guess what that hits?
Yeah.
That hits our GDP growth immensely.
Well, and let's face it, are the real estate prices that we're actually seeing on homes right now being supported by this debt that's coming out of the government and into the real estate market?
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you've got 94% of homes sold last year were FHA financed.
Which is you and I. It's the government. Yeah.
14% of all FHA homes are already delinquent. Why? Because they weren't requiring, even in the midst of quote-unquote monetary conservatism and credit conservatism, what's the federal government doing? Even in the midst of crisis, they're saying you can still get a loan if you can fog a mirror. You can come up with 3.5% down payment, we'll finance your home purchase. Kevin, this has never been a good idea. You have to have some skin in the game. You have to have something to risk. Otherwise, you can walk away and it doesn't matter to you.
Right. It's called a moral hazard when you get everything paid off every time you take a risk and you lose, right?
It's only recently, within recent weeks, that they've raised the bogey to 10%. Now you have to have 10% down to qualify for an FHA loan.
Okay, David, we've talked about public debt, which is our government debt. What about household debt, corporate debt? I mean, these are the debts that we haven't even discussed yet.
What's interesting, Kevin, that the Rogoff and Reinhardt study most recently is looking at a stagnant GDP growth if your debt to GDP numbers are north of 90%.
Mm-hmm.
GDP can't grow if you've got more than 90% debt to GDP. And their study shows that we're at 84%. They don't factor in agencies, the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac paper, as an obligation of the U.S. government, which it is, which brings us to 141%.
Right.
141% of GDP does not include household debt. The most conservative number I've seen on that is 99% of GDP, and the most recent number, as of this morning, 135% of GDP. Corporate debt is 317% of GDP, which is pushing us close to 600%. If you look at corporate, household, and federal government debt, we're pressing 600% of GDP. And that doesn't include the unfunded portion of entitlement programs, which brings us to between 840 and 900% of GDP.
So this is a hollow egg. I remember my mom used to blow the insides out of eggs out and then paint them. Those eggs look just as real as a normal egg until you touched it or crushed it.
And that's what Geithner is assuming can't be downgraded, is the hollow egg scenario.
Yeah.
And he's right, as long as no one realizes it's a hollow egg. But this is the problem. Everyone gets it. The king has no clothes. This is obvious. Everyone sees our financing needs. Everyone sees that there is no appetite to finance this kind of debt. Everyone sees that we're in league. We're breathing the thin air. Along with people like the Japanese, the Lebanese, and the Zimbabweans.
But we haven't paid the price with inflation or a currency collapse, David.
That, I think, is a preview of coming events. I think, Kevin, what we've seen is not only a 30-year credit boom turned to whatever the duration will be, a credit bust, where a tremendous amount of leverage needs to be taken out of the system and bad debts have to be liquidated. But that is, as a part of our overall construct, that is why the dollar is on the ropes. That is why the U.S. bond market is on the ropes. That is why we're facing a tremendous amount of pressure, and ultimately we'll see carnage in the banking sector.
Let's move to the banking sector. Let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, the banking situation that we've had over the last couple of years have been a series of failures of larger and larger banks. Where are we at now on that?
I mean, it's better here in the U.S. than it is in Europe. Tier 1 capital ratios in the U.S. are between 10 and 12%, which is much better than before 2008. Tier 1 capital ratios ex-Britain, because Britain actually took some of the lumps too when they liquidated Northern Rock and nationalized them. And yeah, the British and the U.S. are actually in a pretty decent place relative to the rest of Europe. The rest of Europe is sitting on 6 to 8% cap ratios, and it's stuck in accrual accounting, which means they haven't had to realize any of their losses yet.
Right.
As we were writing down loans last year, I mean, if you remember 2008, the fall of 2008, where banks were writing off tens of billions of dollars worth of bad loans, it doesn't happen in Europe yet, mm-hmm. Kevin.
Well, you said last week they don't have to.
They don't have to, Kevin, because using accrual accounting, they don't have to mark those things to market.
David, you said that the U.S. banks are in pretty good shape compared to Europe, but that doesn't mean they're in pretty good shape. I mean, at this point, aren't there guys right now who are accumulating war chests to take over when this next banking failure?
I think for a relative comparison, it's like having prostate cancer as opposed to brain and bone marrow simultaneously.
Yeah.
I'd much rather have prostate than brain and bone marrow simultaneously.
But the banks still are facing a tremendous hard road ahead.
They are. You know, positive steps being taken by Citi, raising a tremendous amount of capital in that secondary offering, $18 billion plus, and what is likely to be liquidity that helps them survive, thrive, and maybe even consolidate a mid-tier.
Maybe even buy other banks, yeah.
Sure. But I think they're doing that in advance, Kevin. They are raising capital in advance. It makes sense to, because they're anticipating the next shoe dropping.
So everything's ready for another financial crisis. What would be a trigger for another financial crisis?
Well, you've already got credit default swap spreads, which had contracted up until this January, which have now exploded. And so you've got what it costs to insure against default. Kevin, speaking of triggers, it could be anything from a Greek default, a Spanish default, a Portuguese default, anything on the Iberian Peninsula now becomes a problem.
Well, what about the military, too? Some of the tensions that are building right now, couldn't that also be a trigger that ultimately is blamed for what already exists?
If you're talking about Iran or Israel, I mean, that certainly adds a layer of complexity to what otherwise be just an economic or financial issue. But the negative feedback loop here in the U.S., as we've talked about time and time again, is last year, commercial mortgages and commercial mortgage-backed paper, a lot of that is coming due still this year and next. We've got a lot of stress that could instantly be in the marketplace and be a repeat of sort of the dry period, the credit period of 2007 and 2008, and it could be here instantly. Kevin, the European clock is ticking. The estimates of bad debt in Europe are as high as $25 trillion. $25 trillion. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, what is the trigger? It almost doesn't matter because the context is set for the next credit squeeze.
David, I've often heard you talk about how the United States is losing its world share of GDP. You know, at one point, I think it was close to a third of the world's GDP. Now it's shrinking. Who will come in and replace us? I mean, you've talked about the rise of the rest. Is that going to happen, or is the United States, are they the last straw?
Well, Kevin, it's really unprecedented. In the last 10 years, we've seen over a 25% drop in our nation's industrial power. Essentially, we've gone from 32% of the world's GDP to just under 24. And I've seen recent numbers as low as 22% of world's GDP. Mm-hmm. But call it conservatively 24%. That's still a 25% drop. The role that we played versus the role that we're playing today. Put that in concert with emerging markets playing a marginally greater role. And as time progresses, you can begin to see how we lose our voice in terms of international relations. This is a game, Kevin, of relative progress, and I think ultimately of relative displacement.
Well, David, with the dollar becoming a hollow shell and the European markets being where they're at, I mean, it seems to me like gold is really the only option for these countries when they're voting a vote of no confidence.
Well, and that's the point, Kevin, is it's not a rush to gold because people love gold. It is a vote of no confidence.
Yeah, where else do you go?
A global shift to gold signals a universal vote of no confidence. And, you know, so we see that market continue to move systematically higher. And we are in the context of a 10-year bull market. But it's being driven largely by individual investors. Not here in the United States, but in the emerging markets and in the rest of the world. So, Kevin, I think as you look at the U.S. dollar, and even just to put in perspective where it's been and where it currently is over the last 10 years, a significant depreciation, a significant decline, think of the dollar as the stock of the USA. It's been sold off because the fundamentals were negative, and the fundamentals remain negative. And I think that's why we're likely to see a continued sell-off in the dollar. That doesn't mean that we can't have a significant bounce up. In fact, internally to the office, we've been talking about a move to 82.5, maybe even 87.5, which does a lot of things. It puts tremendous amount of pressure on the stock market. In that environment, I think you can see, as the dollar rallies, I think you could see the stock market peel off 2,000-3,000 points. So a tremendous amount of vulnerability there. It certainly begs the question, is gold at the other end of that whip? Do you see gold drop significantly? And I'd say we're within 5% of the bottom. What we've seen, Kevin, is a tremendous amount of buying come in at a significant buying level. The Indians bought 200 tons at $10,045 as an average price, and I think that is largely the floor. If we slipped to $1,950, that's not catastrophic by any means. That's the bottom of this move, and I would be looking at $1,080 to $1,050 as the ideal time to be adding two positions. And again, we're not talking about speculating in the long side of the gold market. We're talking about, just like the rest of the world, gold as a currency alternative.
Right.
As an option that's not the euro, that's not the dollar. That's what you're getting, is a not the vote.
Right.
It's not the dollar. It's not a treasury. It's not a German bond. It's not all of these other options, which are inherently unstable.
Wouldn't you say, David, on these days that we see on the daily ticker, that the dollar's rallying and sometimes gold is down, some of these corrections, it's still people in the old paradigm of actually treating gold like a commodity instead of money? It's strange. Gold will drop a couple of days, but usually we get a recovery right after that as money flows into it, using gold as money, not as a commodity play.
And that's the point, is gold is emerging as a currency play, not as a commodity. To go back to our early points about being in a universal fiat system, this is an experiment which we don't know what the outcome will be or can be, because it's never been done before, except that we know that every fiat system has failed.
Mm-hmm.
The grand experiment here is that it's never been done globally.
It's the world.
You always had, in the context of someone on the continent, playing with fiat currencies, the French, for example, because they destroyed their currency several times. You could always go to the British pound because they were backed by gold. You always had someone who represented stability, someone, someplace, some currency, which was an alternative to a fiat system. Now, the system, the only system, is fiat. Mm-hmm. And so where does that take you in terms of reconfiguring a world monetary regime? That's why I think you begin to see special drawing rights offered through the IMF as a multi-currency alternative, and begin to see the Bank of International Settlements and significant players in the Asian markets begin to introduce gold as a key component backing their currency. Kevin, we're on the cusp of change. We're actually in the midst of transition. It's just not complete yet. And we've got the old guard, which is holding on to ideas and assuming that everyone else is playing by those ideas and by those rules. Meanwhile, everyone else is already moving out and moving on. And I think if I were to look at a chart of gold over the last 10 years, you don't see a bull market in gold. You see a bull market in pessimism against the system that was. And it is a vote as an alternative to move to something else until they figure out what the system will be and how to re-engage more productively and proactively.
Well, and David, you had talked about this being an experiment, only larger. It's now global. But actually, we have seen on a national level this experiment fail multiple times. Like you said, currencies fail. But if you look at the next step that's taken, the next step to reintroducing a currency, if you look at the Weimar Republic or any of the currencies that are major currencies, there seems to be a forced return to gold because they have no other option. So is that a possibility even from a world currency standpoint?
It's a growing reality, and the more I look at the past of monetary history, the more I look at the future and see gold as a part of it. Kevin, there's never been an exception that during periods of tension, during periods of change, whether that's political, whether that's economic, whether it's financial, monetary, certainly, investors have either been on the right side of that or the wrong side of that, and thus have either been treated exceptionally well and kindly, or it's been cruel and devastating.
You've got winners and losers.
You do. And I think one of the things that I'd ask our listeners to consider, have they recognized significant trends? Have they seen the transitions away from them? Or to those significant trends, who are they partnered with? Who are they working with that is engaged with them in this process? I think also, Kevin, a question that our listeners need to consider, where do you get your information? And this is one answer, but there are many others. You know, having Bert Doman on a few weeks ago, his letter's excellent. We have Mark Faber, who puts out an excellent report. We have Ambrose Evans Pritchard, who writes for The Telegraph, and that's free. You don't have to subscribe. You can get it as often as he's writing. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the point, is that during periods of uncertainty, it is incumbent on you and required a greater degree of diligence to gather your information and to understand the time. So where are you getting your information? I think that's a vital question. What are you invested in? Certainly during periods of political crisis, individuals have to maintain a greater degree of control over their assets. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we're in the context of, Kevin. I think we have made the transition from being this simply being a financial or economic issue to it being a political issue. And we're going to see the gloves come off between now and November as people fight for turf. People fight for turf. It's no longer about GDP growth and jobs. It's about who stays in power, who keeps control, and what are you willing to do to keep it. Once you have it and you don't want to lose it, all bets are off. There's no holds barred. So, Kevin, we've got 6 to 9 months of the gloves coming off, and politically, they're being somewhat of a free-for-all. And I think this is definitely a period of time in which you want assets which are outside of the computer clearing system, where you have control of your future financial destiny to the greatest degree you can. And that means looking at alternative assets. That means looking at something like gold. Again, as a currency alternative, as a hedge against inflation, as a hedge against government stupidity. That's really what we're talking about, is people doing the wrong thing at the wrong time and making a bad situation even worse. And that's what you're doing, is protecting yourself against government, not just malfeasance, but incompetence.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, Kevin, this is a very fascinating period of time to be in. If you have not gotten control of some of the basics, then start very simply. You have a cash balance at your bank. Get a safety rating on the bank.
Right.
You have institutional risk sitting with Charles Schwab, Morgan Stanley. Take a look at their credit rating. You can do this. Research it online. figure out who the institution is you're working with and what kind of credit risk you have with them. Is it possible that, and keep in mind, this is a rule change just here in the last month or so, is it possible that you sitting in money market funds with a Morgan Stanley all of a sudden don't have access to those funds? You realize that up until a few weeks ago, they had to go to the SEC and petition any institution. I'm not picking on one here. Any institution with a money market fund had to go to the SEC for permission to freeze the fund in case there was mass withdrawals. Now they can do it arbitrarily. They don't have to have permission. They can shut it down and you lose liquidity instantly overnight.
Money markets can be treated as the same as cash.
Exactly. So why are they changing these rules? What do we anticipate for 2010? And what should you be doing? Who are you partnered with? Where do you get your information? What are you invested in? Are you fully engaged yet? Are you thinking, are you having dialogue with friends, family members, colleagues about what's happening in the world today and the implications for you?
Well, and not really just today, but are you building a relationship with somebody who can help you down the road as we change this paradigm?
Exactly. Is there significant trend changes? I hope for a better world, and I look forward to a better world, a more productive business cycle, whatever terms you want to put it in. The question is, when do we get there? How do we get there? Have we kept things intact, and can we make a transition? And that, I think, is what's the positive side of this and what lies ahead for us.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or call us at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.